expecting some other people, but, you know, it's 1:05, so we want to be respectful of everybody's time. I'm Andrea Firsand from Greater Twin Cities United Way, and I'm going to be helping facilitate today, and thought it might make sense first to just go around and have everyone introduce themselves, and if you want to just tell what organization, if you're with an organization, and what role they play in financial education, that would be just a helpful starting point. And we'll start with our chairs here. We've got, well, I'll let you introduce yourself.
I'm Kevin Murphy. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Commerce Department. I'm responsible for the licensing and regulation of financial institutions in Minnesota. That includes banks, credit unions, insurance companies, finance companies, payday lenders, all that kind of stuff. So in our office, we see the carnage from people who are unsophisticated in financial matters, and we get complaints, and so we see firsthand street level issues there. I'm very interested in financial literacy. I'm also on the board of directors of the Jumpstart Coalition, which is a nonprofit entity whose mission is to forward the cause of financial literacy in Minnesota youth. So I'm part of the latter task force here and in this financial education work group.
All right. I am State Representative Ron Szymanski, District 18A, rural Minnesota, McLeod County, Meeker County. I serve on the House Ag Rural Economies Veterans Affairs Committee's Public Safety, Finance, and also Crime Victims and Criminal Records. I'm fairly new to this process, I hope the other folks at the table will, you know, bring their skills and knowledge to this group so that we can formulate, you know, a nice working document that we can further pursue the ladder out of poverty. Thank you.
I'm Karen Thompson. I'm also on the Jumpstart Board, and I work with junior achievement, and so we are, our efforts are to work with students in the state of Minnesota to help raise their levels of financial literacy.
I'm Janet Dietrich, and I'm with Karen, Junior Achievement. My background is in public affairs and lobbying, but I have never lobbied in the area of financial education before, but it's interesting, a good topic to go forward on.
Hi, my name is Amanda Degas. I'm the Associate Counsel with the Minnesota Bankers Association, and a large role of, or a large responsibility that we have is to educate the employees of our member banks. So we work directly with bankers.
My name is Monica Weber. I'm the Political Advocacy Director for the Minnesota Credit Union Network, the trade association representing all the credit unions in the state. Financial literacy is a very important part of the credit union model. A member of our staff is on the Jumpstart Coalition board as well, and a lot of our credit unions also do financial education for their members.
Todd, I'm with the Federal Reserve. We do some consumer compliance regulation and also there's a financial education. I've worked with Jumpstart and I'm on the board for the Council on Economic Education. I also have no experience in lobbying for anything, and I hope I'm not doing so by being here.
No worries, we're not lobbying today.
My name is Darlene Sliwa. I am an analyst with Senate Counsel and Research, and I staff the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee, the Business Committee, and also the Economic Development Budget Division in the Senate.
My name is Jenny Schwope, and I am working with the Office on the Economic Status of Women.
I'm Pam Johnson with the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. We're the membership organization of the 28 community action agencies throughout the state, and we provide two financial education curriculums to folks that receive our services, and it's required for folks who participate in our IDA program, which is called FAME, Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota. That's a program that folks can buy a house, start a small business, or go back to school with their matched bank savings accounts.
I'm Megan Giacino. I'm an intern at the Minnesota Women's Consortium working on the Minnesota Elder Economic Security Initiative.
My name is Kim Schaff, and I'm a FAME coordinator at Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington Counties. And there we facilitate financial literacy classes every month, and they're offered free to the public. So it doesn't matter what income level you are. We encourage parents to bring kids, but they can't be too young or else it gets a little bit difficult, but mainly for adults.
My name is Dan Duham. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services Office of Economic Opportunity, and we are the state agency that oversees the state IDA program, which has been mentioned, FAME, and we've also, we're partners in developing the state curriculum for financial education, both the four cornerstones and four directions that Pam mentioned earlier. We primarily fund nonprofits in the state of Minnesota working in anti-poverty efforts.
I'm Kate Overson. I'm with West Central Minnesota Communities Action, and we are the grantee for the IDA program known as FAME Statewide. And so it's my opportunity to oversee our 24 sub-grantees who offer the individual development accounts throughout the state, and also then focusing on the asset building strategies as well as the financial literacy that is required for each of those programs.
Hi, I'm Trish Olson, and I'm with the University of Minnesota Extension. And in Extension, we have a number of programs. We have 20 staff throughout the state that teach financial literacy both to professionals and train the trainer and individuals and to individuals. We do a lot of online education as well as in-person training. And I'm happy to help facilitate today. And Jane, you want to introduce yourself? And just so everyone knows, this is being recorded. Okay, it's just so you know. We just thought we wanted everyone to be aware of that.
Apologies for being late. My name is Jane Stockman. I'm from the Minnesota Council on Economic Education, also at the University of Minnesota. And we provide professional development to K through 16 educators and also provide student challenges in economics and personal finance education.
Hi, I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Department of Education.
Hi, I'm Beth Owney. I'm the Director of Academic Standards and P16 Initiatives at the Department of Education.
Great. Well, I think that's everyone. Thank you so much. And you'll see as you start to, in a moment, we'll be looking at kind of a map of financial education services. And you'll see many of your entities are on there, and you can kind of get a sense of where, kind of where you are in that layout. So we thought, first of all, there is a sign-in sheet if at the end with a green claimant pen. If you could grab that and just pass it around, all you need to do is check off next to your name. And if you're not on there for some reason, just write in your name and your email address so we can make sure that you get on the list. For future meetings and for that summary. Is there anyone who might be willing to take notes? We just need to submit a summary document to OEO, who is staffing this Ladders Out of Poverty Task Force. And my backup person isn't here.
Well, I think I could take notes.
Okay, yeah. I can take notes as well. Okay, so we got that out of the way. We thought we'd start. We thought we'd start with an overview of financial capability, and I'm thinking maybe before that, even though, just you should all have a document that just frames this in terms of the Ladders Out of Poverty Task Force that was formed relatively recently. I think out of the legislation this last session. And it has three subgroups. One is financial education, which we're here today to talk about. One is asset building, and then the other is community supports. And everyone has an opportunity to serve on multiple subgroups if they're interested. That all that information is on the website, and you should have all that information right there. And my guess is with the emails that have been going out, you're probably already looped in, but I just wanted to at least frame that for you. And this is, I want to say it's a two-year task force, time-limited task force. Is that correct? Is that ringing a bell? Okay. And essentially our objective is to really begin to develop a work plan with some actionable items. And we thought today we're going to really just start by providing a foundational overview of what these kinds of services, what these programs look like in Minnesota, who the stakeholders are, what their roles are. And certainly we've begun to do that even just through the introductions. And then Tricia's really going to provide us with an overview of some new terminology that's being used nationally around financial capability. And so we wanted to share that information. And then lastly, we're going to really just dive in and begin to have a more meaningful discussion around financial education in relation to the K-12 school system. Social studies standards are being updated right now, and we thought this would be really an important time to begin having that conversation and seeing if and where those opportunities might be for ensuring quality outcomes for students in the K-12 system. So I'll hand it over.
As you can see, we just have a short time to introduce some concepts to you and share with you some ideas and definitions that are really pushing new in the field as recently as this fall. So you think, and we're here to talk about this task force is called Financial Education. And we have heard the words like financial literacy, financial education, financial knowledge. And how does that all fit in with Ladders Out of Poverty Task Force? There is certainly an understanding or thought that education makes a difference, right? And yet in the field of study, the word capability is starting to show its head in multiple places. And so we thought, one benefit for you to come here is maybe to get exposed to some new things that are emerging in the field of study. Therefore, as we have our discussions, we have a foundation on what's emerging in the field. One, the handout that you have in front of you is a short, I think it's four pages, called From Financial Education to Financial Capability. Opportunities for innovation. We just wanted to share that with you so that as we have our conversations both today and in the next 2 years, it might be a nice framework for you to think about as we make ideas, suggestions, provide information as our legislators think about what things might be put into place to help Ladders Out of Poverty. Financial capability is a little different from education. In this particular model or this white paper provided by Center for Financial Services Innovation, which is out of Chicago, they're saying that education is more about knowledge, and with an emphasis of capability is more toward outcomes or change in behavior. For those of you who are educators, and I certainly count myself as an educator from the University of Minnesota, I would never think of education without thinking of behavior change. But this is a change of thought in the field, and it's more than just semantics. It really is looking at how are we looking at the broad idea of education to help toward behavior change, because that really does matter in the end, is what people do with the knowledge they have. There's a couple of highlights from this four-page summary that I'd like to show for us to think about. On the front, it's those four visual yellow dots. In what's saying, what have they found through a review of many programs, both educational and programs of behavior that work? The four bubbles there say that it's relevant to those who are using it, that it is ongoing, it's not a one-time shot, that it's timely at the time that the people need the education. We often find, of course, home buying education is helpful when you're buying a home, not 10 years before you're buying the home, right? And that it's actionable, which is a nice big word for saying that, you know, they can put it into action right away. They don't have to sit on it and think, oh, when I'm ready to use that credit card, I'll think about it. It's at the point of time of use. So those are nice things to keep in mind as we think about all these opportunities we have for what can we do in the area, in this group of education, toward impacting poverty in Minnesota. The second page emphasizes a matrix, and everybody loves matrices, right? You know, what's on the left side, what's on the vertical, what's on the horizontal. But it's a wonderful way, this particular matrix is a wonderful way to explain the continuum of services and education that can go on within the broad category of financial literacy, financial education, or financial capability. On the left-hand side is, how intense is it? Is it just kind of something that somebody gets stuffed in their in a mailer or something attached to a credit card information? So it says, is it high touch? Are they pretty intense? Or is it pretty low touch? Something people read. On the bottom is, it says, what's the degree of commitment from the consumer? Everything from communication, perhaps something that you read or look at on the internet, all the way to really engaging one-to-one with someone either over the phone or in person. I think those two visuals, both the bubbles of which show best practices, and this framework for financial capability of how intense and how involved is the participant, are nice ways for us to, again, frame the information that we will be receiving in the next today and in the next 6 months. This is just a short four-page from a larger 22-page report that you can get at the website of this organization. Again, it's one of many models, but I think it is what's really quite new in the field, and I think it's you deserve to hear what's emerging in your participation here.
Great. Any questions or comments about that piece before we move on?
Not strictly speaking about that piece, but that piece did cause me to look at the agenda where I saw a reference to it, and that caused me to look at the third bullet on the sheet, the agenda sheet, you know, which proves me that we definitely are talking about K-12.
Today, yes.
In addition.
Are we going beyond K-12?
Yes. Yes. So this is a two-year process. The reason that we're kind of jumping into K-12 so quickly rather than developing a whole work plan is because of the social studies standards being in a period of being updated, and with the legislative session starting so soon, we didn't want to miss that opportunity. But once we get started on that, what we'll begin to do is frame a much larger plan around increasing access to financial education, looking at metrics to tie out to that around behavior change, and, you know, identifying kind of key strategies for not only youth but for adults.
And I guess the one other tie, which I think I want to answer, is that when you talk about the capabilities and doing it at the time of decision making, you mentioned home buying. I guess, are you implicitly saying there that when we do K-12, we would de-emphasize home buying and do other things, maybe credit cards?
That's an interesting thought. You know, I think it depends on where you're. And I think it's for this group to decide, obviously. But I think, what are the decisions that youth can engage in immediately? Usually isn't home buying. And yet, with our immigrant and refugee families, oftentimes it's the children who are our spokespeople for the adults, and actually they get involved. So I don't think it's always so black and white. Understanding that, you know, I think in our latest turnaround with the economy, I think when I was in high school, the house was your asset for, you know, you get a house and that will be an asset that will always grow. Understanding that there's a range of, that things may have changed. And knowing that success isn't always defined by a house with four walls, too. But certainly youth, they're using credit cards, and I think, you know, making things more appropriate to them, but also I think youth need to have a big picture idea, too. They're not... they're very capable of learning a great deal, but emphasizing things that they can apply immediately.
There's the bottom line, that namely that the new learning on capacity you referred to, at the end of the day, doesn't change much what we think what we would take off.
Hmm. I don't have a good answer for that, but I think this room will come up with good answers. I think
that's part of what we need to discuss is what would it look like in K-12? How does it look in other states? And you know, I mean, even the recent article that came out in the community dividend through the Federal Reserve, sharing that information as well.
Any other thoughts?
Okay, so let's look. If you want to pull the lengthy sheet, and it apparently in my formatting, I accidentally cut off the word education system, so it just says map of financial. So excuse that wording there.
It's a draft.
There you go. Yes, thanks for saying that, because this is a draft. You may find that in looking at this, you know, your organization's not on here. It should be on here. This is really just a starting point for discussion so that we can make sure that we're having a visual that best reflects and captures the good work that's happening in the field and then allows us to figure out where it is that we want to take the field. And so this visual on the front, I'll talk a little bit about kind of who some of the players are and kind of key components of what exists, and then you'll notice it's accompanied by some key roles that those different institutions play, so it goes into a little bit more detail. So I'm not going to go through each box on this map, but I'm just going to highlight a few things. You can see at the top are really kind of some of the federal entities, whether that's funders and research institutions, some of the big ones being Center for Enterprise Development, which does a conference every other year, and Center for Social Innovation. Both of those are large research institutions that do some amount of grant making. And then we've also have National Endowment for Education, often referred to as NEEFE. It plays a number of different roles, but one of the roles is it actually is a clearinghouse for financial education curriculum. And then we've got banks and credit unions. Some of you are here today out there who, you know, not only have the financial products and services, but also have a number of different partnerships with nonprofits, in some cases maybe employers. You certainly can talk more in detail about the work happening and put out financial education curriculum. So our have some hands-on components in that piece as well. And there's a number of curriculums I could mention, but I'm not going to start going down that route. And then we've got OESTA, which is a specific entity around the Native American community and different models there for providing financial education. And the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, of course, who does both research, also does convening and partners in a number of different financial education efforts. And then we have the U.S. Department of Treasury, and they recently have begun putting out some draft metrics that the Minnesota Financial Fitness Network, which you can see right under, did respond with some comments. And they're playing a larger and larger role in just really putting together some key strategies around financial education nationally. So you can see a more detailed summary on the description. And then last, you can see the big arrow going across, and that's really the beginning of the state section. We, for a number of years now, we've had a Minnesota Financial Fitness Network. That is a number of the statewide and local players who meet regularly every other month as a network to really share information, bring in speakers, and look at working, you know, when possible, to educate legislators and others around the work that's happening in Minnesota and what we could be doing. So it's also about forming new partnerships as well. And Dan Duhamel brought a one-pager on Help Minnesota Saves, which is really a link to that work, and that it provides much of the resources to the community, to direct service workers to help do that capacity building. So then on the state level, there are a number of players, and I'm just going to highlight a few. There's LSS Financial Services, and then in the regional area, there's Family Means, and I'm mentioning those two because those are two of our only, I think there's another organization in Rochester, but one of the only two organizations where they're accredited to do consumer counseling, consumer credit counseling, thank you, is that correct? And So that's really high-quality services, highly monitored services. It's where a number of folks who work with those organizations refer people for debt management and debt consolidation, and then credit counseling work. And part of what we'll look at further down is the distinction between counseling, coaching, financial education. These are different terms used, and we're beginning to define those terms and what they mean. And so you see that in terms of what some of these players do here. We also have the University of Minnesota and University of Minnesota Extension. Greater Twin Cities United Way is partnering with them on a state online financial education certification program. And the idea there is that will begin in 2012. People will be able to take an online course and get certified as a financial educator. And it will also allow people who are currently working in the field to go and either test out or take certain modules. And it's beginning, the idea is to really begin that quality assurance and that CEU process to maintain the integrity of the work that we're doing in the field and to build on that. And then there's also train-the-trainer workshops that have been funded through McKnight and OEO in partnership with LSS, and then also U of M Extension and Minnesota Council of Economic Education has also partnered on some wonderful train-the-trainer models as well that have been out there in the field to really get people who are doing the direct service trained in this work so that we can further integrate. And you can see there's the big arrow at the bottom because there's so much good work that is beginning to happen or has been happening around integrating financial education into the work that we're doing in human services, whether it be a job training program, a housing program, at a community action agency. So there's a number of different models. And one of the strategies that our community has been invested in is really looking at how we can train and get sort of a baseline level of services integrated to change the way that we work with people in the community so that the conversation isn't just about maybe getting that job, but it's about what are your goals, how do we help you get to those goals by working from a financial education perspective. And then there's a number of other entities on here, so I encourage you to take time to kind of read through this and also to be in contact with either Trish or myself to let us know what's missing or how you'd like to see things reworded so that we can make sure that we have a tool here that can help us as we move forward in the next 2 years. There is a whole section at the right that we're going to dive in a little bit more today between Minnesota Council of Economic Education, Jumpstart, Junior Achievement. I'm sorry, do we have somebody here from Junior Achievement? Great, thank you. Who really work much more heavily on the K-12 piece. And so I'm really not the one to talk about that, so I'll let all of you talk more in detail, and you certainly started to with the introduction. Are there any questions about this before we move on? This is really just kind of to help ground us a little bit. Okay. So certainly please do be in touch because this is a piece that we do want to evolve. So next, Beth has agreed, or I'm sorry, that's right. Yes, yep, Beth has agreed to provide us with summary of some of the work that's happened, been happening to date, and where we're at today with some the social studies standards and just other strategies for really looking at integration. So,
thanks. So I did bring a handout. Okay. It's Andrea, right?
Yes.
I'm not sure. Might that be helpful if we pass that out? This is. Some of you, I think, I've talked with before because we've been to similar kinds of meetings. So this won't be new information for you. But originally you asked me to talk about standards and how that, what the implications are for financial literacy from that viewpoint. So I'll do that, and that's what these slides really cover on the handout. And then you also had asked about the social studies timeline, so I'll mention that. And then you also had mentioned challenges, opportunities, you know, some issues that we might want to consider relative to standards or graduation requirements and financial literacy. So to begin with, in terms of standards, the legislature has a schedule for revising the standards in K-12 education one subject per year. There'll be a break for a few years, and then the cycle starts over. And the social studies standards in Minnesota started in 2004, and they are set to be revised this school year. So we will be launching that process within the next couple of months, and that will be announced on the Minnesota Department of Education website. So, and there'll be other venues that it will go out through as well. But certainly if any of you are interested in the social studies standards revision process and can dedicate, you know, a significant portion of time to that revision process, we would appreciate you applying to be on the committee. The application process will be online too. So I've just now addressed the second item before the first one. The first item, what do the standards say or not say about financial literacy? In the current version, the 2004 version of the Minnesota Social Studies Standards, now remember, standards are the statewide expectations for student achievement in Minnesota. School districts can require more than the knowledge and skills that are in the standards, but they cannot require less. The state of Minnesota is similar to a number of other states in that we have local control of curriculum. So you may see very different kinds of curriculum from one district to the next implementing the K-12 standards, and that would include any standards associated with social studies, in particular financial literacy. So here are the statewide expectations that we have right now in Minnesota. The 2004 standards have one standard that relates to financial literacy all in of itself, and then there are also some benchmarks associated with various standards. In Minnesota, a standard is a goal statement of learning. It's a larger picture version of learning, while the benchmarks are the term that we use to, this is another addition for your glossary, Andrea. The benchmarks are specific knowledge and skills that students must achieve in order to satisfy a standard. So both are very important. Back to our standards. So we have one financial, personal financial management kind of standard. And that standard says the student will learn and be able to apply personal financial management and investment practices. So that's an interesting standard, and I've already received input from some folks that have said, why are they coupling financial management with investment practices? I've had others contact me saying, I'm so glad to see that those two concepts are neatly coupled together. So that will be one issue that our yet-to-be-formed standards committee will need to deal with. More specific kinds of knowledge and skills related to financial literacy are in our benchmarks. And there are three benchmarks associated with what we would call financial literacy. The first one is on slide four here. The first one is for students to analyze short and long-term investment options, such as stocks, bonds, real estate, and mutual funds, by comparing the risk, return, and liquidity of these instruments. Okay, so a very specific thing that every student in Minnesota must master as a condition for graduation. Number two, the second benchmark related to financial literacy. The students will recognize a proper role for credit and how to utilize risk management strategies, including the use of insurance. And then a third specific statement, a third benchmark is, explain the concepts of compound interest and the rule of 72 and the applicability to both investment gains and debt retirement. Okay. Those are very clear statements directed toward financial literacy. And then we have some other kinds of financial literacy concepts that float in the other content areas of the social studies standards. We have the whole concept of the market economy, which is represented in our microeconomics standards, which are part of our economics content area. We have the national economy concepts, again from our economics portion of the social studies standards. We have essential skills of economics that all students must master. And then finally, there's a grouping of skills associated with international economic relationships. So depending on what your framework is for envisioning what a holistic model of financial literacy looks like, this aligns very well or not so well with what should happen with all K-12 students. Now, these standards and benchmarks are at the high school level. There is very little, and some would claim nothing, associated with those concepts as we map downwards, K through 9. So that's a serious thing. And, you know, as the director of standards, I know that that's an issue that really needs to be addressed, because financial literacy can't wait until students are in high school. So I'm editorializing a bit there, but that's a strong feeling I have. There are every time we revise the standards in a subject area, there are new kinds of research that have emerged since the last time, many new kinds of instructional best practices that relate to both behavior and knowledge of students. So we want to reflect those developments to the best degree possible when we revise the standards, and that's why it's a long process and complicated. But in a nutshell, these are the official concepts and skills that currently all students are asked to master. So that's the standards piece. I mentioned a little bit about our standards development launch, which will be, within the next 2 months. It will unfold over a period of several months, but it must all happen during this school year. The standards will then be given from the standards committee to the commissioner, and that person can approve those standards as they are, or say, you know, I like this thing, but not this thing. I'll look into whether this particular item should be changed. I should tell you that within the past few years, the drafts that have emerged from our standards committees have been approved by our commissioner. So I am happy to say that our commissioner has been able to support the drafts that have come in mathematics, science, the arts, English language arts most recently, and hopefully social studies will be the same way. So that's a good thing. This process is rather complex for revising the standards. The first thing we'll do is try to get a committee together that reflects a variety of interests and expertise. First and foremost, we must have people on the committee who thoroughly understand social studies, K-12. So we need to make sure we have all five major content areas of social studies addressed on the committee. And those five areas are U.S. history, world history, civics and government, economics, and what am I forgetting?
Geography.
Geography, thank you. So those are the five areas of social studies that are addressed through our standards. And the tradition has been to address the financial literacy through the economics standards. So that's the first step, to get a committee formed that has the expertise to carry this through. By law, we're also expected to include numerous other kinds of stakeholders, parents, administrators in K-12 education, post-secondary are included on the committee. Business representatives have a strong part to play on our committee. When we develop the first draft of our standards, sometimes it's the second draft, but at some point we take the draft out there to the public, and we go around the state, and we have a public comment period. And the public can attend one of several town hall meetings and just tell us what they like or don't like about the suggested revisions. They can also give us feedback online at the department. We'll have an application set up for that. So there are a lot of ways for the public to be involved in this as we go along. We also come to a point where we think the draft is good enough that we should really float it by the eyes of some experts in the field. So we have some expert reviews conducted on the draft, and then those reports come back to our standards committee and more changes are made to the draft. And I'm just giving you the highlights of the process. We do an extensive gap analysis every time we review the standards. So we look at Minnesota's standards, and this is the really humbling part, and often our committee gets quite discouraged at this point because the purpose is to compare ourselves to the best in field. So a real hard thing every time is to figure out who is the best. What's the best state in terms of social studies standards? And then internationally, can we benchmark ourselves to any countries in this regard? Certainly in math and science, we were able to do that extensively. And then we analyze the gaps between our standards and theirs, our achievement compared to their achievement. And then that informs our analysis as well. But that's a very hard thing. Hard process to go through, a critical kind of self-reflection. So all of that goes into creating a draft that finally goes to the commissioner for approval. So that's the standards development process. That's the first part. After that's done, we proceed through the state administrative rulemaking process, which takes anywhere from, I'd say, 10 months to a year and a half. And what we're doing there is making the case before a law judge that these are high-quality standards, that these standards address a need for all students to have these knowledge and skills. So in a nutshell, that's what the process is, and that will launch within the next couple of months. Andrea had also asked me to talk about some challenges, maybe opportunities associated with financial literacy and the standards. If you want better financial literacy education, there are a number of ways to go about it, and one is just through excellent curriculum, and some of you have been involved with curriculum efforts that make that happen. The challenge then is, in a local control state, how do you get the word out, and how do you get lots of school districts to use that curriculum because it's not mandated? And in fact, I think you'd find strong resistance if there were any kind of statewide, you know, move to try to mandate any particular curriculum, because we have this challenge in every subject area. And the legislature has been pretty consistent in saying we want the results, the outcomes of education specified, the standards. We want that end in mind. And then we want to allow local flexibility for them to pick curricula or write their own curricula that addresses those standards. We want, and that's how we encourage innovation. So that's typically what has happened in our state. Sometimes, because, you know, there's this push not to mandate curriculum, people have tried to get certain kinds of knowledge and skills inculcated in the K-12 student population different ways. One is through requiring standards in a certain area. In social studies, this has happened. In social studies, the lawmakers said, we will require 3.5 credits of social studies encompassing U.S. history, world history, economics, civics, and geography to satisfy the standards. So they were giving direction to MDE that said, when you do standards for social studies, do not leave out geography, do not leave out U.S. history, do not leave out. So that was a strong message to the standards committee right away. So that's one way they do it. Another is through course credit requirements. Currently in Minnesota, students are required to complete 3.5 credits in social studies that address all those standards. So if we have financial literacy standards, which we do to some degree in the current standards, all kids must, as part of their 3.5 credit requirement, learn those standards. So those are some things that have happened in the past, and that's probably, well, those are really the predominant strategies that policymakers have pursued with our K-12 standards and relationship with the graduation requirements. I hope that makes sense. That's kind of a very quick and fast
overview. Thank you. That's a really helpful overview. So let's open up to questions, and then what we can do from there also is there was a report put out and a great article through the Minneapolis Federal Reserve on sort of what some of the other states are doing and specific to these standards. And so maybe it would be helpful if I just quickly went through. What I did is there's a survey of the states. It's a report card put out by the Council for Economic Education. And I cheated here. This was a much longer report. It had three sections, one on economics, one on entrepreneurship, and one on personal finance. So I just took, because this is a lot of paper, took the section on personal finance. And if you look for Minnesota,
that's a good one.
You can see here where we fall in relation to other states, and this really gets at what Beth was just talking about with regards to the, you know, one way states reporting required student testing. Another thing is states reporting high school course be taken. So here's some kind of gets to those. Here are some strategies that we can look at what other states are doing. What it doesn't do is necessarily do a full kind of assessment report around. So those states that are doing high school course required to be taken, you know, what kinds of results are they finding from that? And I think some of that we find in this article through the Community Dividend that are showing, suggest important positive short-term and long-term effects of the training. But it doesn't get at, you know, like graduation requirements. How does that help versus some of the other strategies? At least I don't have that information. Others may. So I thought that foundation would be helpful as a comparison point. And then let's just open it up for questions.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment because I was at yesterday's asset building work group, and one of the things that we're looking at that is to eliminate some of the predatory lending practices and predatory consumer products that are out there. And I think we have all seen that with subprime mortgages and payday lending loans and those types of things. And there was a gentleman, and Sandy, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he was from U.S. Bank, sitting next to you? No. Okay. He said something interesting that stuck with me, and he mentioned that you can regulate all of these things out of existence to a point, but in a capitalist market, things will continually pop up that would be considered predatory and take advantage of people in low income or of any income, really. But there has to be financial education in order for us to get people the knowledge for them to identify this as predatory of some, you know. And I actually surprised myself agreeing with him in the fact that, yes, we can regulate and regulate and regulate and try to get these practices up, but knowing how government works, we can never work as fast as the consumer market works. So in order for us to really get rid of these things, we have to have financial education. And what shocked me when you were talking, Beth, is that I remember in grade school learning how to balance a checkbook, but that wasn't a requirement that's put in here that you mentioned. Or what I never learned what credit cards were in high school, and those types of things. So it kind of surprises me that those aren't talked about, those basic consumer products aren't talked about in high school or grade school or wherever we want to start that, just to tell people what they are and introduce them as students. And I think that's one of the reasons we probably found ourselves in an economic down problems is because people just weren't sure what predatory meant or what it would look like or what good products may or may not look like. But just understanding the basics of personal finance is something that helped us get into this problem in the first place. And I'm editorializing a little bit. But I do agree that if we don't educate people on what are good and bad products, they won't be able to discern for themselves either.
Yeah, that's a good point. And one thing I want to point out, though, is that do not assume that checkbooks or whatever aren't taught just because you don't see it in the standards. If the standards are good, they should be reflecting higher level concepts, principles, thematic understandings, higher level processes if it's a skill-based thing. It shouldn't, you know, it's not to reflect all of curriculum. So I know that, you know, taking care of a checkbook is, you know, I've heard that it's taught in a lot of curricula. Regardless of whether or not you see that word used in the standards. But you know, it goes without saying we don't have K-9, we don't have K-8 standards on financial literacy.
I have a question about the benchmarks. Could you explain how the benchmarks are currently enforced?
Currently, there is no enforcement kind of function with academic standards and high school graduation requirements. The Minnesota Department of Education has no authority to enforce what local school districts are doing in that regard. So this puts heavy responsibility on having a very good, sharp local board of education for your school district. We don't have standards police that go in and say, you know what, you're implementing these standards, but not these. We don't go in and audit school districts that way. So currently there is nothing.
So do you know, I just have a question with regards to this other larger report on the states. When states are reporting required student testing or that a certain course be taught, are there enforcement practices there for ensuring those pieces?
In some states there are. In ours there is not.
There isn't. Okay.
And that's quite typical. Many states do not have enforcement mechanisms in place.
And what do those enforcement mechanisms look like in other states?
Well, I'll start with our state. We do have an annual report that's due called the Annual Report on Curriculum Instruction and Student Achievement. So some people see a reporting requirement on all of your curriculum, which would include financial literacy, as being some kind of accountability to the department. A lot of states have that kind of accountability. But in terms of enforcement, some actually have power or authority to go into a school district and audit their curriculum for one or more purposes. And that could be one, a curriculum requirement. Others could withhold funding. I mean, it varies tremendously from one state to the next.
Okay. Dick, you had a question?
Yeah, just I have friends who have strong views, which I don't have, about whether there should be a separate financial education standard, maybe outside of social standalone. And I'm not going to ask you whether that's good or bad, but if there were people who wanted to do that, what would their process be? Would they need legislation? I mean, if the people I know who favor a separate standalone financial education standard, if they were to pursue that, what would they do?
You mean a separate requirement, not a separate standard, because they already have a separate standard.
Okay.
Yeah. But if they wanted to require something outside of the standards, like a course requirement, that would take legislation requiring it.
Mm-hmm.
All of
the framework now is from legislation.
Right.
We have these categories defined by legislation.
Right. All of the.
There's no other place. You wouldn't put it in English, I don't think.
No. It naturally fits in economics and social studies, and most states would see it that way. Another thing to be aware of is this emerging Common Core State Standards Initiative in social studies. Common Core Standards have already been developed in English Language Arts and Mathematics. The next area that they're going to address is science and then social studies. So, and that will happen, of course, isn't this how the timing goes? That will happen after we have finished the revision of our social studies standards.
So is that the same as saying, like, core curriculum components?
No, and that name is very, can be misleading that way. Common Core State Standards Initiative, the Common Core part of that title refers to the goal of having all states having the same set of standards. So if, for example, a student moves from Minnesota to Oklahoma, they're going to be held to the same set of standards that they would have had before they moved. It's about economies of scale. It's about the opportunity to develop statewide assessments in common versus every state reinventing the wheel, a very expensive enterprise. It's about being able to compete with the best countries in the world who have, you know, common sets of standards. Common not meaning that they're ordinary. Common meaning that they all share. They're rigorous, but they're shared in common. And states would adopt them voluntarily. And in Minnesota, we have adopted the Common Core English Language Arts standards and added on to those standards a bit where we felt they were a little deficient. And in mathematics, we have not adopted those Common Core standards, at least not yet. The commissioner didn't have authority last year to adopt mathematics, only English Language Arts.
When a standard is in, say, social studies, you know, there's all kinds of folks who can and are very capable to teach personal finance, and it could be family consumer science teachers, business teachers, and those in social studies. When it sits in the social studies, does that kind of in any way limit family and consumer science or business educators from teaching that, or does the school district kind of figure that out?
That's controlled by state law regarding licensure. So, for example, the legislature has already provided for that relative to economics. Their specific wording is you must have 3.5 credits of social studies encompassing U.S. history, geography, world history, economics, and government citizenship, or 3 credits encompassing U.S. history, geography, world history, government citizenship, and a 0.5 credit in economics taught in a social studies, business, or agriculture education department. So that, I think, was the legislature's message to the world, that it is perfectly fine for that kind of content to be taught in those departments. Those standards are not the exclusive privilege of social studies standards, of social studies teachers. They could be taught by teachers in other fields who have the appropriate licensure. But that always becomes an issue in our state. I can't tell you how many questions we get from school districts. Here's how we'd like to deliver the standards in this area. We think it would best meet our students' needs if we had these 3 options. And option number 3 involves a teacher from a subject area that's kind of outside that subject area, but whose license may or may not cover it. So licensure is always something to consider when a district determines its options.
So there's a few challenges. One, there's whatever direction you go with regards to curriculum. And then there's the challenge around having the professional capacity to then teach the work.
Yes.
If I'm understanding you correctly. And then there is the piece around just in the enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So ensuring that it's making a difference, but also ensuring that, that it even gets implemented in the schools.
Correct. There's a 4th piece I would add that often policymakers don't think about unless they're very into curriculum kinds of issues. But that is curriculum coverage. Right now, and this has been going on since the mid-80s, there has been a push to add more and more and more into the curriculum. Little things, bigger things, and the largest things. And then people are astounded when our students graduate and in financial literacy, earning, you know, scoring at the 53rd percentile in Minnesota for financial literacy. I mean, they're astounded when these things happen, when yet teachers are expected to deliver everything and kids are expected to soak it up like they're little sponges. So when standards-based education is well done, the standards are at the highest levels of knowledge and skill. They're not getting into all the specifics. The benchmarks are still rigorous. They're at a high enough level that teachers are thinking, all right, I can teach this particular benchmark in about 3 class periods. The minute we start thinking, well, that's important, we're going to add it into the standard. That's important, we're going to add it. There was a study done that said if you would take all of the standards that have been proposed by the national content organizations like the National Council of Teachers of Math and so on, each of those content areas, the typical school year would be well beyond 365 days. That's going to school on Saturdays, Sundays, and night. So there's just too much there. So the smart thing to do is to really figure out what is the most what are the most important knowledge and skills in financial literacy, and then get that in the standards and have it mapped coherently from kindergarten all the way up through grade 12. But start with the question, what does this look like in terms of college and career readiness? Because that's where our legislature has asked us to aim. It's asked us to aim very high so that when students master all of Minnesota standards, they are prepared for any path in post-secondary education that they want to choose, and they're prepared for the workforce. So what does college and career readiness look like with respect to financial literacy? That's the question that needs to guide our back mapping of the standards. And then we just need to be parsimonious about it instead of putting everything but the kitchen sink in.
So prioritize this might be better than one.
Exactly.
I have a question. I graduated with a degree in social studies secondary education a few years ago, and I know that financial literacy was not part of any of the standards or requirements in 02 when I graduated that I had. Is that being implemented into, okay, so we have these standards, we're going to teach these things. Are the teachers being trained in that field? Has that changed for the licensure, or...?
I think it's better than when you graduated, and certainly than when I graduated from high school. It's changing. I don't think it's changed as quickly as it has changed in some other subject areas that have really been in the spotlight, like mathematics or reading.
So I know the year before I graduated, the state passed a law saying all social studies teachers will take a Native American history class. And that was just passed by the legislature, and then they came to every college, and they were like, told every history department, you must now offer this. So we had to create extra college classes that then everyone had to take in the one semester before their student teaching to do that standard. So I didn't know if that idea has been trickled down then into the colleges of education for, you know, their knowledge and preparation.
It's hard with social studies because there are so many content areas. It covers such an expansive array of issues. I think that may be why I was thinking about this. I didn't know whether to put this out there as an idea or not, but you make me think of this more. And that is how to use financial literacy as an integrator of other content areas. So rather than an add-on, it becomes a lens through which you view macroeconomics, microeconomics, government and citizenship. Some you mentioned about predatory lending practices. Am I saying that right? That, you know, would that have anything to do with government, your study of government? So, yeah, you could do a case study of that. So that's what they've done in science. In science, rather than teach separate engineering skills and separate, we now have engineering in K-12 science, rather than have separate engineering, separate scientific inquiry skills, those skills must be taught not in isolation but with the life sciences, with the physical sciences, with the earth and space sciences. So a similar thing could happen.
Okay, that's something you were thinking about.
That kind of leads... We've been going around my question here all in this whole discussion, and that is, in your presentation, you said the financial skills education standards or benchmarks are 9 through 12, and yet, you know, we know that the elementary grades is where we can start that process in basic mathematics, teaching the students the mechanics, you know, how to calculate interest rates, how to... you know, understand, you know, the monetary concepts and so forth, that the one concept that, you know, kind of rings true is if we want financial literacy, we got to teach them good financial habits, and habits started early are more effective than, and I'm considering, you know, with the banking representatives in the room here that, you know, back when in my youth, you know, the biggest thing that we had was going to put a few dollars in a passbook account in the bank and get some interest on it and say, hey, I didn't have to work for it, but I made a little money on it. So somehow we've got to get that down into the elementary grades. I don't know, you know, you're the educators. I'm not how that's playing out in today's economy. But I get a little concerned when we talk about social studies curriculum without the mechanics of understanding, you know, money, interest, and compound interest. And that kind of goes back to the concern about predatory lending. If those victims of predatory lenders understood what interest rates are and, you know, the real true cost of it, they would not be so subject, you know, to the predatory lenders. They would, you know, be more defensive in their financial dealings.
In response to your comment, the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics came up with the same conclusion, that there are certain real-world applications of mathematics that every student ought to master. And some of the examples you gave are what they cited. And I think we have very strong, rigorous mathematics standards, and our standards committee in the 2007 standards inserted that in there. So our elementary, so in the examples for benchmarks, they give interest. How you compute interest, how you work with investments. They're not teaching the entrepreneurial or the, you know, all of those aspects, but they're teaching the mathematics behind it and how that applies to mathematics principles. The compounding of interest, that was another example that's in our math standards. So, you know, I like this idea about how they integrate together with other subjects.
There have been a few studies lately that show a pretty strong correlation. They're social science studies, so getting from the correlation to knowing what's causing things is always hard. But they're showing a fairly strong correlation between people's numeracy and their financial behavior. People who know fractions, percentages, things like that, tend to have better outcomes. So I'm telling financial educators that you're a math teacher, your friend.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, John. Oh.
We were talking about enforcement before, and if there's no enforcement, how is the communication? Do the schools all know these standards exist? And are they all encouraged to follow them? Is that pretty well established at this point?
They know what the standards are. They're encouraged to, they're more than encouraged, they're required to follow them. And some school districts have better school boards than others. Okay. And some local communities are more involved in what goes on with educational policy and review of curriculum than others. So I don't want to say that all the standards are implemented with fidelity in every area of our state, because I know that's not the case. But I also know that most school board members take that job very seriously, and they would be they'd be chagrined if they thought their school district was not covering some portion of the standards. I also think educators take that seriously. And now teacher education programs are heavily focused on standards-based education. So you hire a new teacher in a school these days, they want to know, okay, which standards am I responsible for? Because that's what their curriculum has to reflect.
Dan?
I'm finding this fascinating because I'm not a K-12 educator, so thank you for indulging me a little bit. Something I want to ask you about that you mentioned about when you look at the standards, you really focus on college prep and getting people what they need to do, getting ready for college or for the workforce. Where do life skills fall into that? So it's great that we're getting people ready to go to college, and it's great that we want them in the workforce, but just the basic life skills, because I see some of this financial education as just a basic life skill.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to be careful with that, because the legislature requires rigorous academic standards, and we're not to create habits of mind or dispositions or behavioral kinds of standards. We are to create academic standards. So a good debate for every standards committee is, what are those things that make for a good mathematics student, a good science student, a good social studies student? And we have to separate out those things that aren't measurable through academic skills or knowledge versus those that we think are really important for students but don't fall in that realm. Those things that don't fall within the realm of the academic standards because they're not knowledge or skills, academic knowledge or skills, but they're really important, then fall into the realm of curriculum. So it is incumbent on districts then to figure out what degree to which they want to inculcate those other kinds of things that they deem important.
So that might be an obstacle or some sort of challenge that we may have here when talking about the skills of financial budgeting, mm-hmm. Being able to, I mean, I can see where we can talk about math skills and being able to calculate interest, but when we're just talking about basic financial education, like the curriculum that we help develop at the state for implementing the FAME program and to deliver to low-income people, I wouldn't necessarily think of those as academic skills, but more life skills almost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, you know, there certainly are studies that claim to show that lack of financial discipline has a negative effect on your workplace productivity. Bad credit report is the most common reason a soldier is not deployed after getting trained.
Wow.
Financial problems are among the leading causes for people dropping out of college. Now, those don't make those skills academic skills, but they do seem to say that you need a certain amount of financial knowledge to be ready for college and the workforce. Is that an acceptable logic, or would that fall flat?
It's acceptable to some degree, but here's the thing. We often look to standards or one thing as the magic bullet. And standards can't do more than what they're supposed to do, right? So we have to keep that in mind. There are maybe there's a package of options for addressing a particular issue, but standards is just one piece of that package. Here's the other thing. I have very strong belief that knowledge does change behavior. It doesn't always. But I think our most effective teachers are those who find ways for that knowledge to be embedded in authentic, real-world kinds of performance tasks, the kind of engaging instruction that kids want to talk to their parents about when they go home at night. You know, our best teachers are doing that. And I have a hard time. I wouldn't be in education, I think, if I didn't think this way. I think education has enormous potential to address all kinds of issues. So I think if you have effective instruction and you have it all along the way reinforcing the same important high-level kinds of knowledge and skills, students are going to be engaged and I think more prompted to change their behavior in that regard. I don't think it'll be everything, but it's a big piece.
I'd like to push a little bit on the integration that you talked about. So if there are priorities that looked a little bit at kind of some of the core pieces and, you know, either the Four Cornerstones curriculum that Dan's mentioning or, you know, other curriculums out there. And we were to look at how do you get at some of those increases in knowledge and ultimately skills and behaviors through integrating into other core pieces like economics and you know, other coursework, then what might that look like? And I'm wondering, because I know Junior Achievement's out there, they're bringing financial education into the schools, and I've seen in elementary schools models that very much are about integration. And so I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit about kind of what's working from your experience.
Thank you. We do, just in the state of Minnesota, we deliver about a million hours of Junior Achievement curriculum to the students, through about 6,000 volunteers going into the classroom while the teachers are present. And it is integration of both through very much what you were talking about, Beth, is using financial literacy to talk about civics and citizenship and other entrepreneurship budgeting. Because I was just reading just the standard that we have right now about the students being able to apply personal financial management and investment practices, and to me, that's budgeting. I mean, that is if a student can leave school with mastering personal financial management skills, that is a budgeting skill, I think. So what we do, K through 12, is integrate that with real hands-on activities. But it integrates it in meaningful ways and very age-appropriate and with relevant activities. And the same program that is done in a third-grade classroom or a first-grade classroom is done in North Carolina as it's done in Minnesota, as it's done in New Jersey. And then in our high school programs, there's an array of programs that those teachers can select from, primarily done in our social studies curriculum. But I'm not exactly sure what you're asking me to address, but it is business and citizenship, financial literacy, and it's all is woven together. So it retains the student's interest, but drives them to self-realize that they are in charge of their financial success, mm-hmm. and elements of that financial success is staying in school and taking their education seriously. Starting personal goals towards education, towards career goals. So as they move up the school ladder, they stay in school, they go to high school, they graduate, but they also have those goals in place as they move up into grade 11 and 12 and then eventually into 13 and 14. Mm-hmm. So is that how you...
Yeah, I think it's helpful for all of us to be aware of that model. And also, I guess my question back to you would be, you're starting to kind of touch on some of how I assume you're evaluating the program, and I'm wondering if there might be value in looking at that as far as, okay, here's one model that's, you know, that's working, here's the kinds of metrics that are being produced through that model, and is there a way of bringing some of that potentially to this discussion around social studies standards? If it's about looking at how we teach economics, how we look at teaching, civic engagement, or, you know, whatever the host of things we do in social studies, having that kind of discussion. So I'm trying to draw some links here and wondering what you and others think about that.
Sure. As it relates to evaluation, we do evaluate on a national level, evaluate our programs on a regular basis. We're actually bringing someone in from our national office this next month to mm-hmm. talk to locally to us about the evaluations. To your point, and I do believe it's is it Trish? Trish, I think that you had brought up a question about how can people who may not have the licensure but certainly the expertise start to help educate our students. I think that is a huge benefit that Junior Achievement brings to our students, or at least offers to our teachers, because as our teachers are present and assist the volunteers that come into the classroom, and they're always present, it is the business community that comes in and teaches these Junior Achievement programs and integrates their experience and their expertise into all of these lessons. And it is through those individual experiences and those messages that they can share and integrate into the package lessons that we give those volunteers to share that I think the greatest learning occurs. Be happy to share evaluation materials with the group, with yourself.
I think
yourself.
That'd be very helpful.
Okay. In the future.
Others? Thoughts on that?
I just wanted to point out, too, that as Beth was saying, there is the one standard for the 9 through 12 currently that specifically addresses personal finance. But if you look at some of the standards for K through 8, there are standards under economics for K through 8 that talk about really fundamental foundations for personal finance, such as decision making, understanding needs and wants, understanding scarcity, that you can't have what you want. So how do you make decisions? I see one standard here. I have them in front of me. For economics grades K through 3, one standard is the student will understand that economic choices are necessary in life.
So a benchmark is students will identify the difference between basic needs and wants. Students will explain that money can be used to buy goods and services. Students will understand and explain that the concept of scarcity means that one cannot have all the goods and services that one wants. And it's interesting that some of these can lay the foundation for how do you attach these to then the applicable personal finance skills that you want as far as budgeting, saving, spending. But there are some fundamental layers there that are already included in our standards.
Other questions or comments? Thoughts about, you know, here we have a great model of how it's kind of happening outside of the, you know, traditional regulated system, the community working in partnership with the schools. Other thoughts about kind of what we're doing and what other states are doing in terms of trying to standardize this, trying to look at enforcement and components that you would like to see here or like to have considered? I mean, Dick had mentioned his friends talking about a separate financial education course. I assume that was what you were speaking to?
There, I know people who advocate, would like to see the law changed, I think, to have something outside of the social studies standards, specific to personal. That is not...
Yeah. Well noted.
One way or the other. You know, I think that the current train leaving the station is the existing standards.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to note is we don't know a lot. I mean, Trish alluded to the fact that the knowledge has changed all the time, and it is, and we're learning new things. But we don't, from a hard research perspective, I would say it's still true that we don't know a lot yet about what actually works. There's some studies on both sides that point in various directions, but it's not a well-established large body of knowledge that says, you know, if you want someone to come out of high school well-trained in personal finance, here are the four or five things we know you need to do. I don't think the field is there.
I think one reason many of you came today thinking you probably didn't know what to expect. But when we were working with our chairs and thinking about how to help facilitate this, it kept coming up. We would talk about adults having challenges and being in poverty. And there seemed to continually be this little dialogue that would say, but if only when kids went from high school to maturation, when they were 18 and they were automatically... hopefully graduate from high school, then they are well prepared to live in the adult world of financial management. So it's always easy to kind of blame, you know, if we only got them prepared in the community, we wouldn't have these problems. And then it came to, well, what does preparation mean? What do 18-year-olds, what do high school, what should we expect from high school graduates? And so I think that was why we said, okay, well, let's talk about that. Plus, the social studies standards were there. It's not to think, you know, that everything will be solved by the high school, what happens there, but it is a piece of the puzzle that there's this window of time to provide some recommendations to the task force, who in turn, this group will then in turn meet with the larger group to provide some recommendations for ideas that could be helpful. Yet many of us in the room work with folks well past 18. They're 25, they're 30, they're 35, they've lost their home, they're homeless, they can't get enough food stamps. They're we think, oh, if only they would have learned this back then. There's a whole nother discussion around when we have them at 25, 30, 45, 50, 65, 70, you know, other things to help with the ladder out of poverty. But we do want to leave today with some really good ideas after a discussion of recommendations that this small group can take to the larger group. And so I think we really do want that conversation to happen and to to think about what might be some specifics. Yes, Dick.
I would offer a procedural one more than a substantive one.
That'd be great.
Looking at what Beth handed out, to me, it's not that I think the benchmarks are bad, but I don't. They don't strike me as being complete in some sense. And I take your point, Beth, that we don't want to micromanage and try to drill down to every last item. But even at a high level, I think this group or some other group might do some, you know, brainstorming back office work, kind of off the scenes work to maybe put forward some candidates that we could sort through and prioritize, maybe flesh out the benchmark. I don't know if that would be helpful.
Yes.
Yes.
Could I follow up? You said this fascinating phrase that I'd never heard before, that we're not, as the educational K-12 system, we're not to create habits of the mind.
Oh.
Can you talk more about that?
And this goes back to with the profile of learning repeal, which was in 2003, some of the reason, and I don't know if any of you remember that, but when we first started tinkering with standards, that was in the mid-90s. And first we had outcome-based education. Those were outcomes. And outcomes became called standards. And the vision of what a standard should be has continued to evolve over time. So what we had in the late 90s was the profile of learning, and then in 2003, those standards were repealed and replaced with something called Minnesota Academic Standards, which is what we're talking about now. In the profile of learning days, the late 90s, people were debating what should really be in a standard. Should it be all kinds of knowledge and skills? Should there be just a few standards, or should there be many standards? Should the standards be related to themes that cut across all content areas, that rise above the content area, the discipline, so to speak, or should it be someplace lower on that hierarchy? Should they include more things than just academic knowledge and skills? Should they include habits of mind or dispositions? And so habits of mind became one of those phrases used synonymously kind of with behaviors, dispositions, habits of mind. For example, you know, Costa's research, when he came out with his research at that time showing the characteristics of what he called intelligent behavior. One of the key characteristics of an intelligently behaving person is perseverance. Okay, so since perseverance is a trait that you see universally in intelligent behaviors, then should that be pulled in and reflected in standards or not? Now, the good side of that says, yeah, because it's important. But the downside, the people, those against it would say, but how do you measure that? And whose definition of perseverance? And there are many other kinds. But in the profile of learning days, the answer to that question, policy-wise, was solved by creation of a set of things called task management skills. That sounded more exacting and measurable than habits of mind or behaviors or dispositions. So you had only those things included in a short list. I think there were five of them that they thought were pretty measurable. So perseverance, while some could argue that's measurable, that was not a task management skill, whereas time management was.
Representative Schmitz.
Thank you. Well, now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it said this agenda was not to enforce habits of mind. Is that what it, you stated?
Yes, with the Minnesota Academic Standards, we're not to include habits of mind, dispositions. It's supposed to be about academic knowledge and skills.
Okay. All right. They're
tough to divorce the
two. All right. That's what the basis of my question is. Habits of mind, and, you know, I'm referenced, you know, getting students to in the habit of saving money and those types of things. Well, that would be, in my interpretation, a habit of mind. Mm-hmm. But it also kind of goes all the way down to, you know, the young adults, you know, who struggle financially, generally based on having made some wrong decisions in their life. And so I'm wondering, you know, where does moral education come into this whole process? You know, having the capability of making right choices, right decisions, you know, from an early age on. Because those, you know, bad choices don't just start after adulthood. They start in youth. And so somehow we've got to, you know, find the proper balance, I think, you know. And I, you know, when I talk about morals, some people would think, well, that, you know, tends to be, you know, religious indoctrination and so forth. But I kind of go back to my early days, things like Aesop's Fables and things like that we, you know, learned in elementary school. You know, there's just little social concepts that really can, you know, have an influence on a young mind.
And to hear me talk, you know, it may sound like there's a very strict line between one and the other, between habits of mind or behaviors, dispositions, attitudes, and academic knowledge and skills. And, of course, it's very blurred. It's hard. But the curriculum that a district chooses is all about that. It is all about standards and what kinds of values do we want to impart to our students? What kinds of behaviors do we want to see exhibited?
I think if you go far enough in the direction where some parents are going to say, you're parenting my child, then you got to push back to one side or the other. Because I want to parent my child at home. Mm-hmm. Far enough to get that push.
So we have one suggestion come up. I mean, you had mentioned that you're going to be forming a committee soon to be looking at these standards. I imagine there's some folks in this room who might want to be a part of that, and whether that conversation happens in this larger group or through this subset, you know, either way that information gets you. And Dick had suggested looking at maybe expanding or, you know, maybe even relooking at the benchmarks. And I'm wondering that the next slide that you had was financial literacy concepts are also embedded in these sub-strands. And what concepts? Is there room for looking at identifying kind of core concepts that get embedded and how that's done? I mean, not so much curriculum, but, you know, that these core concepts get embedded so that we get a little bit more specific on kind of the accountability part of this?
Those are some of the things Jane read, right?
For K through 8, yeah.
Yes, for K through 8, and so kind of taking that up into the higher grades as well with these standards.
I think the answer is yes. What is really needed for a standards committee are some authoritative documents in the field. So before we launch the review process, we have to compile what are the best reports and standards documents that we have in this particular discipline. So I need that for economics. I need that for financial literacy if we're going to have some strong discussion about it. So that would be one need. What are those? If you could only have our standards committee read one or two reports, what would they be? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, one, two, or three documents that would be seminal documents, what would they be? I'd like to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also it would be good for someone who really understands the development of knowledge and skill to say, what does that look like at kindergarten? What does it look like at high school? And then to kind of lay out, we'd call it a learning progression of knowledge and skills in financial literacy. And then that would be a starting point at least, and the standards committee could say, that's too detailed, we can't incorporate all this. Or they could say, look at what the big picture things are in here. Let's make sure that that's in our standards somewhere. Mm-hmm. That would be helpful, I think.
Do you have access to the standards that are out there from other states that have incorporated it, from Jumpstart, from the Treasury, all of those people who have promulgated ideas along those lines?
The public, I mean, everybody has access to everyone else's standards. What is helpful is if we don't even have a full-time social studies specialist at the department. So who does this work? So here's the deal. If there are analyses that have already happened of other state standards relative to financial literacy or personal financial management, whichever way you go with that, that's very helpful. And I don't know what's happened in that field. If such, I don't know if that's available.
So you're saying even without maybe someone in this room being on the committee, you still need these documents that could be provided by this
right.
group.
Because I've seen enough debates in standards where it's one opinion against another. And if there's been scholarly research in the area, that really helps.
I kind of have a twofold question, and I feel like I need to educate myself more on this, so that's where these questions are coming from. Is it easy to find the Minnesota standards, or could you get that to the work group that we could post online to understand what the standards are that are out there? Because this is a great step for me to see what they are, but it's kind of hard to provide information that I think would be relevant for you before I understand what the true standards are in Minnesota, because obviously I'm missing pieces because I didn't know.
The standards are on our website.
Okay.
The Minnesota Department of Education website, which is education.state.min.us. I screwed up with my email address. It's education.state.min.us.
That'd be great. And then I don't, as a fellow state employee, I hate these questions too, so I'll apologize in advance. Do you have the information as to how districts across the state are addressing these standards within their curriculum? You don't. So that's what we may not know. We're trying to answer questions that, or provide direction to districts that you don't do at your level. And we're talking about that level, and we don't know what districts are doing because there's a lot of districts using the Jumpstart and the Junior Achievement curriculum, and there's some districts that have done their own stuff. So what we don't know is how they're addressing these because, it says personal financial management, but what one person thinks is personal financial management is not what somebody else feels is personal financial management. And the fact that it's coupled with investment practices, I have no idea how to play the stock market. So, it's like you couple those things together. And it depends on that school board and that school district's definition of what that is. And we don't have that information. So
someday I hope before I retire for Christmas that I get, as a present, as a standards director, that I get the present of data from magically I get this gift that says, here are how the standards are being implemented in every school district. And I can just pick that subject area, and I can see how many districts are really doing a good job.
Keep sitting on Santa's lap.
You said they do have to report to you?
No. The state of Minnesota has no reporting requirements. I know what you're thinking about, Dick. They have no reporting requirements where they have to tell us how they're implementing the standards, but there is a state statute that requires school districts to submit an annual report on curriculum, instruction, and student achievement. And they have to send a copy of that to the department. But these reports tend to be very nice brochures about what's going on in the school district and give some data. Usually it's looking very favorable kinds of data. So it's a PR opportunity as well as an education opportunity for the community. But that doesn't get at what I would love to have.
And I, with the agencies we fund, we want that too. But.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there are some key next steps in terms of support that this group or members of this group could be providing around analysis of other state standards, what some of the leading research is, financial literacy within the K-12, and summary of kind of the learning progression. So are there people here who would be willing to, and we also have the data coming out from the national report. What's the time frame on that from Junior Achievement?
I think I should be able to provide something within the next month to 5 weeks.
Okay, so we have that as well.
The National Council on Economic Education certainly has their buy-in. Is it every other year or biannual? Their assessment that in some select schools in Minnesota take that. I think that's what you were alluding to, the 53%. It would.
Jumpstart and that stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jumpstart.
They went to a different system.
Oh, they did. Okay, so I go off the board for a year.
That was from, yeah.
They've not heard a new system yet. They're moved away from the old system, but they haven't implemented
it. Yeah, so the last one was done in 08, spring of 08, and I don't know when there will be another.
We did, for the first time, get Minnesota results on that one.
Yeah.
So we have 1 point.
Right. Hardly a trend.
Unfortunately, we were in the average. We weren't Garrison Keillor's necessarily above average in that case. And that's an assessment done by, you're right, Jumpstart, but the National Council, Minnesota Council facilitated gathering the data on, it was a knowledge-based assessment of financial literacy concepts.
But Trish, what is the NEFI report coming out soon? Was there an evaluation with NEFI?
So these are things that we certainly could provide to the department or put it together. I think providing information is one thing, but data can be overwhelming if it's not put together in a meaningful way for people. They don't have time to read all this, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what I heard you saying is there a small group who might want to help pull that together, and we could either have them email us. It might be the easiest way to do that.
What we can do is send out an email afterwards and then ask people to respond who are interested and kind of identify key follow-up strategies and who would be interested in providing some support for that. And then I just want to make sure you get a moment.
I have a question about the benchmarks again. Are they in statute or are they rules or where do they appear?
The standards are in rule. And then the benchmarks are not. The benchmarks, the requirement for benchmarks is that when they are complete, the commissioner must publish them in the state register. And they need to be published right after the rules are made for the standards. So you see posted on our website the draft that's given to the commissioner of what the standards and benchmarks should look like. Then we put those through rulemaking, the standards only part of it. And then after the standards are approved by the law judge, we publish the benchmarks and let everybody know that the standards and benchmarks are done. Does that make sense? I mean, school districts don't wait for that whole process. They usually start changing their curriculum as soon as the commissioner has signed off on the draft and we put it on our website.
There have been considerable criticism of the benchmarks. I was just trying to understand how they came to pass and how somebody would change them if they didn't like them.
To this point, it has been, the commissioner has always believed that we don't have the authority, the agency or the commissioner doesn't have authority to change benchmarks and standards until they're up for review that year. So it's in the year of review.
So the review process is the mechanism where changes are made.
Correct, to this point at least.
Sounds a little bit like inside baseball.
How is that?
Well, it requires a lot of time for somebody to attend all these meetings.
Yes.
I know that you introduce these to the public, but that's sort of down near the end.
No. No, that we have the public involved from the very beginning with the announcement of the opportunity to be on the committee. And then depending on what the discipline is and what the questions are, we have to go out and find information from different kinds of stakeholders. It just varies from discipline to discipline. But then we find out what the concerns are, and we find out, and much of this gets submitted online. And we have a long process for that, you know, sometimes 2 weeks to 6 weeks for the public just to tell us what they like or don't like or want us to think about. All of those comments, every single one, gets shared with the committee. And that gets entered into our gap analysis. And the public comment period, sometimes we have even more than one, and the public comment period never is less than 2 weeks. It's often quite longer than that. Public can provide comment on anything about the standards when they want to. In terms of written feedback, I'll always send it to the chairs of our committee, or they can come observe our meetings, and many people have done that. And then that's another way that, you know, the information about the committee's work spreads. But it very often is a two-way process.
And how do people get put onto the committee?
They apply online at the Department of Education website. They're asked to provide information in a number of areas so we get some kind of idea of their expertise, because we want to make sure we have all of our subject areas well covered, and all of the different kinds of roles have to be on there that are mentioned in statute. And so we try to come up with different arrangements, and the commissioner looks over the field, and she or he has to make the final determination of who's on that committee. So it rests with the commissioner.
And how many committee members would there be?
We've had anywhere from, since we started revising the standards, from committees of 25 to over 40. And I'm thinking social studies will be one of our larger committees because there are so many content areas. But here's another thing. So those are the regular committee members. They attend all day long standards committee meetings, and many of them work on the technical writing team. These are the folks who make most of the wording changes to the standards at the direction of the committee, and they meet even more often. But then we get in touch with experts, as we call them, consultant experts. So in this case, someone might say, you know, you don't have anyone on the standards committee who really understands financial literacy. Maybe we need to go to some group or individual and get their input on something. A good example is English Language Arts. Last time around, we did not have the Common Core English Language Arts standards did not include any Native American titles about Native Americans or titles by indigenous peoples, and we felt strongly we should have some titles on the list that reflected that. We didn't feel our committee had the best expertise to recommend individual titles, so we had to go to outside experts for that. And we do that more and more with our standards. And that's another way the public's involved. When we did science and engineering, we needed to go to the business community to find out engineering applications that may or may not be reflected in our science standards. So there our business folks from the Chamber of Commerce were real helpful, and the partnership, Minnesota Business Partnership, in helping us find some working engineers who could give us a reality check, so to speak, on what we were putting in the standards.
So two questions. One, when we send a follow-up email and just ask if there's people willing to kind of start gathering some of the research and doing some of the analysis, what's the best way of moving that forward? And then the other piece is, could we also look to members of this group and, you know, kind of communicate via email and assess interest in whether somebody would be interested in contacting you to be on the committee?
They shouldn't contact me because I get hundreds of,
okay.
of emails.
Go through
so,
that.
Yeah. What there'll be an online application process. That's what they need to access. In terms of this committee's work, though, if you just want to contact me for any of that stuff, we can work together,
okay.
the three of us. But certainly all of the things that you volunteered or suggested would be helpful, I think. They'd be helpful if they're timely.
Which people can obviously, everyone knows they can go on and apply online to be on the committee. I just think the only reason I bring it up is to ensure that some of the expertise and conversation we're having today, that we have a means of ensuring that we're getting that voice on the committee. And so just closing that loop to ensure that happens.
Well, and another good idea might be to have a small core of individuals who could be consulted if our co-chair's on the committee. We always have a post-secondary co-chair and a K-12 co-chair.
Mm-hmm.
If they have questions, they can contact that person or group directly. If they have an idea in mind and they want to run it by some financial literacy folks, mm-hmm. that would be really nice to have.
And what's the best way to orchestrate that?
Just give me compile the information and send it to me.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'd really like that.
Like a team of consultants?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, we call them phone-a-friend list last time around. Very official title. Let's call them outside consultants, yes.
Let's go with that, yeah. Well, that's some helpful next steps.
Very
like five people. Sometimes a committee's meeting, they have an urgent question, we need to get on the phone right away. And if we only have two people, they're always gone or, you know, mm-hmm. busy. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to have about five names to call or contact.
So we want to talk a little bit about next steps in terms of this group. And there is a larger meeting happening. You have it, Trish,
yes,
November 18th of the Ladders group.
So all the three subgroups that we talked about before, the group that is working on asset development and the financial education and the community group, all three will have an opportunity to report back to the larger group, which will be meeting Thursday, November 18th, 1 to 5 in this room. And, again, those are all public meetings, so you're welcome to attend. I think what we will do with the chairs of the committee is we'll put together something we can run it by this group to know what we would be putting forward. And it is, that'll be now after the election. So I think that then at that time they will determine how we move forward as work groups. You know, they wanted to hear kind of this first kind of cut on what we're doing, knowing that one meeting is not adequate to talk about all the things that each group needs to talk about. But at the November 18th, they'll set up a plan of action for how to continually get to encourage the small work groups to meet and receive the information that the larger group needs. We are really supporting the larger group of Ladders Out of Poverty.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, ideally had the timing on this not been so tight, as I mentioned earlier, we would be putting together the work plan and really identifying kind of key strategies for financial education as a whole. And so that's one of the things that we'll want to do after the November 18th meeting as a work group. And I've begun to just kind of draft a framework for that just to give us a way of kind of beginning on that task. And so look for that meeting date that we'll put out. I imagine it would be sometime beginning of January, since December is kind of a nightmare, but we'll see.
Yeah, and the timeline that Andrew's alluding to is this urgency with the social studies standards, that we didn't want this opportunity to be missed when we could encourage folks to be involved, and first to be informed and then to be involved. And so that's where we kind of mm-hmm. did things a little out of order here, but we thought it was real valuable. So mm-hmm. we cannot thank you enough for your information. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for the invitation.
And make sure that you did check off on the sign-in sheet. Oh. And if, so we have it right up here. And if you want to add anyone to the list, or if for, you know, some reason you do not want to attend future meetings but maybe want to be involved in a conversation or just kept in the loop, certainly you can let us know that as well. So thank you, everybody.
And Representative Shemansky or Kevin Murphy, do you want to say some parting words for us?
Well, I certainly appreciate everyone's taking the time to join us today. I think we've gained some valuable insights into you know, the different perspectives from whether it's industry or education or social services, that, you know, it's a looming, large looming task in front of us, you know, and it's something that I think we can address effectively, but, you know, we won't have overnight solutions. We will be long-term solutions that we're driving for. So thank you for attending today.
Again, thank you all for taking the time out of your busy lives to be here with us and share your knowledge.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm not going to give it to you.
It's not.
We'll
be there with you.